if you have enough data in your system, it's not going to work so great. It could be really slow, crash, certain reports won't come out. And so if that happens, of course, that's a clear indicator. But then even separate from the technical limitations, the volume of your business increasing just increases the complexity of tracking the financial implications of various parts of your business. If you want to start seeing how to improve your cash flow, you need to see who's spending money on what. And so if it's just a big pool of here are all my expenses, you don't have it broken out by department or person or revenue, you can't see, oh, well, are these expenses helping me get more money on, you know, increase sales? And so when you're small, that's a lot easier to do. And as you get bigger, it gets more complicated. And that's really is just kind of slicing and dicing your data in different ways to be able to perform that sort of analysis.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder, along with my long-suffering partner, Richard, at procurementexpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's spending with magical features, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Ben Taylor, founder of SoftLedger. And Ben's come along today to discuss some of the pros and cons of moving away from QuickBooks and into some of the common solutions around here. The most common one we hear of these days is NetSuite. He's heard some of the pros and cons of doing that, and we're going to have a chat about it. But before we get into that, Ben, maybe you could just intro yourself for the listeners and tell us where you are in the world and give us a bit of your background.
Sure. Thanks for having me on. My name is Ben Taylor, co-founder and CEO of SoftLedger, and my background's in accounting. I'm a CPA, and I've come from very big company auditing and reporting background. And then when I started SoftLedger, I was working in the accounting department for a small public company, and it just took too long to get the financials every month. I like to say we didn't know how we were doing on January 5th until February 27th, because it takes until the end of the month to close the books, you know, that could be weeks. And then all of a sudden, you don't know that a vendor invoice that came on January 5th was $100,000 higher than you expected it to be. And so that it just seemed like that process could be solved quicker with software. And so I called up my longtime friend, Jeff Ostrega, and he went the computer science route as I went the accounting route. And we built a mid-market general ledger. And yeah, we went full-time a little over 7 years ago now.
So tell me, back at the very beginning, how long did it take you from a cold start to get to your first customer?
So we were doing it nights and weekends for a while, even prior to going full time. And so if you count that time, probably approaching 2 years before we got our first customer, maybe a little more actually. So we went full time, we had something, prototype, we thought we had something, and then we went to demo it, which was a very quick and painful way to learn where the gaps were. And it took about 10 months before our first paying customer went live.
Well, what kept you going for 2 years? Because, like, are you dumb?
There's an argument there. No. So during the nights and weekends stretch, we still had day jobs. We were still just kind of like, okay, we think there's something here. Let's work on it, work on it, work on it, get feedback, do all the, you know, go and pitch the idea just informally in networking events and stuff. And right. Then we kind of learned more about what we needed to do to make it successful, realized, okay, well, we really need to go full time. Let's find a first investor. And then once we did that, we thought, okay, we're ready to go. Let's go full time. And then that's when the clock started. When I said 10 months, it was 10 months into doing it, to trying to sell full time that we got our first paying customer. General Ledger is, it's got to be right. Every time there's a little thing wrong, you immediately lose confidence with whoever you're selling to on it, because it has to be right 100% of the time. So if there's one little bug or something, you know, we're going up against these large global companies that have been in the market for decades, and we're held to a high standard from the beginning. So that's just kind of the case with a general ledger, I think. And we learned that as we went. And yeah, a lot of those initial kinks, it just took a bit to get them worked out.
That really resonates, that it's not until you burn the boats that you can really start the clock. I guess you could have gone forever not selling part-time, and then it took that commitment to be able to do it. So you raise a point there about credibility. Now, 7 years later, you've got lots of customers. It's kind of obvious why you'd be a customer. But customer number one, Like, who was it? How much did they give you? What did you do with the money once they gave it to you?
We were so excited to get it at the time. And then in retrospect, it's not that. So our first customer, we got through a relationship that I had, and it was somebody that was downgrading from another accounting system, Sage Intacct, actually, in this case. It was because they went bankrupt. And so it was just a place to store their data. So we're like, oh, great. You know, first customer. And explaining it to some people, they're like, oh, it doesn't sound like a really attractive market, which it doesn't. But it was the first one. And it was a technology company that was like good to talk about the use case. And it was coming off of Intacct. So, and then that helped us get the next one and then the next one. And so, yeah, that was January of 2018. And then, yeah, we got another one in February, another one in March, another. So it just kind of built steadily. It wasn't like the doors were flying off at that point. And that's been kind of the story to date is, you know, we've just steadily grown over the past several years. A lot of this stuff builds word of mouth, you know, people using it, going to, you know, switching jobs, and they're familiar with SoftLedger.
They call it the long, slow SaaS ramp of death. It's true. It's been true for us as well. Like, just that little pony, you whip it, but like, it's going to do what it's going to do. Mm-hmm. But you got the first couple of customers in, and then for the second and third customer, when they asked a dreaded question, is anyone else using this? You're like, oh yeah, sure. We're storing some data for a day company, but you don't tell them that.
Right.
That gets you at the next level. So you obviously raised some money to get you over that 10 months. You're probably rations at that stage.
Yeah.
And then did the investor have to reinvest again to get to profitability, or how did that work out?
I guess there's two main key raises. Are the first one was Mucker Capital in Santa Monica, that we went through their startup accelerator. That was our first check. That helped us get started, gave us some credibility on its own, enough to start paying ourselves salaries and going, oh, this is going to work. And then realizing after several months, oh, okay, this is, let's got to trim that back. We got to be, you know, in for the long haul a bit. And then about 3 years ago, actually 3 years this month, we got our seed investor, Naples Technology Ventures. So that was the first large investment that we got had gotten. I guess those are probably the two pivotal investments. In between, we had some angel investments, another startup accelerator we went through, Forum Ventures. But it was generally small checks in between that initial investment. And we did get to being cash flow positive prior to raising our seed round, and we are again. So we've teetered on that, and being efficient and growing that way has been very key to getting where we are today.
Let's talk about what we're here to talk about today, because you and I have a common sort of market in that we often both are working with people who are working QuickBooks to an inch of its life. They're maybe growing a business. You'd be surprised how big companies can get just on QuickBooks alone sometimes. But the other solutions can be quite daunting. Suddenly you're dealing with consultants and rollout projects and all sorts of things. And there's a Goldilocks zone you and I both play in, I guess. So let's discuss a little bit of the problems. Like, how do people self-identify? Like, if they're using QuickBooks right now, give us an idea of the problems they typically bump up against just before they start talking to you.
Well, I always say volume is what does it. So volume of your business transactions increases, and to a point where when you start, you have one person in the marketing department, for instance, maybe, or no one. And so you don't need to track that separately. But then at some point there's three, and maybe there's enough expenses there that you need to add a cost center to transactions to track marketing. And then you have a couple of different product lines because your revenue has grown enough that it's material to track the differences. So you have to track each of those separately. And so there's just this dimensionality to your financial data that needs to be tracked. And it needs to be tracked in a controlled system designed for an accountant who you've also probably hired. And that's really the key indication that it's time to switch. And our thought is, okay, you shouldn't have to switch an accounting system and then need to hire people to use it, which is the case for the incumbents, is like a NetSuite or Dynamics. You're going to have to hire consultants to come in and implement it. And you're probably going to have to hire more people for your team. And so it's just this step change in how much you're spending on that part of your business. And a lot of cases, you don't need to do all that.
Okay, let's stick on QuickBooks for a bit. So I heard the volume thing. So is it that what you're logging in and it's like taking 20 minutes to open a screen because there's so much data in there, or the reports are so slow, or is it just you can't find the data in there? It's all becoming a bit of a mush.
Well, that is a part of it. I mean, that's a real technical limitation, is if you have enough data in your system, it's not going to work so great. It could be really slow crash, certain reports won't come out. And so if that happens, of course, that's a clear indicator. But then even separate from the technical limitations, the volume of your business increasing just increases the complexity of your of tracking the financial implications of various parts of your business. If you want to start seeing how to improve your cash flow, you need to see who's spending money on what. And so if it's just a big pool of here are all my expenses, you don't have it broken out by department or person or revenue, you can't see, oh, well, are these expenses helping me get more money on, you know, increase sales? And so when you're small, that's really, it's a lot easier to do. And as you get bigger, it gets more complicated. And that's really is just kind of slicing and dicing your data in different ways to be able to perform that sort of analysis.
So it'd be interesting to compare here. Let's play a bit of bingo, right? I'm going to tell you some of the reasons people come to us and what stubs their toe in terms of their SME accounting software. And maybe we can compare notes here. So one of them is, you know, they have a lot of locations. They have two or three retail outlets. Suddenly they have a second manager and now they have two or three more. In QuickBooks, you have a very limited way you can segregate the data, like you mentioned. Suddenly you can't give each the store manager their own report because there's no way to do it. Like,
yeah, that's a good point. I kind of didn't highlight one of the main things we see, and that's for multiple entities, multiple business locations, having a way to bring all that together in one system. There's just not a good way to do that in the small business systems like QuickBooks or Xero. Like, there's no multi-entity consolidation concept, and then once you get into that, now you're in this very like heavily architected multi-entity consolidation tool like a NetSuite that in that example you just gave, that's a lot. If you just want to track multiple stores and have good visibility into them and you don't have 1,000 stores, then that's probably going to be overkill. If that's the core reason for making the switch.
Sure. And then the next one we get related to that is you have 1,000 stores. Hell no, I don't want 1,000 store managers logging into my QuickBooks account. So access control is a big driver, just being able to hide. Ironically, it's not adding a feature, it's being able to hide features from other people is a big one for us.
Yeah, that's another thing. Another reason we see companies outgrowing QuickBooks or other bookkeeping systems is the granularity of user controls and how you can fence things off. It's not quite deliberately designed for that type of use case, which is complicated. I mean, that's, you have a full system, which and this is something that we do, is that you can have the master user that sees everything, and then the individual store manager in that case, you could strip it down to just say, all they can do is come in and see a list of invoices and upload one file. That's doable. That's a kind of a modern software approach that we see a lot of if you're going to build a system now.
Yeah, a lot of this comes out of the fact that, I don't know, when QuickBooks, I vaguely remember their web version starting in the early noughties, I think. Cloud software was barely a thing back there. They were trying to catch up. Most people were using desktop. It felt like even back then it was kind of like a scramble for this fairly big company to offer something. We do a lot of integrations with them. And just keeping up to speed with all the changes they're making, which is progress, I guess, but it does mean retraining. Suddenly that doesn't work anymore. Suddenly this is not in the API, you know, and that's all time out of your day to retrain just so you can do your job. You're able to do last week and now it's changed. You can't anymore, you know?
They got to be doing something right. They have millions of customers. Not a lot of business software providers can make that claim, but they've been around for a long time and they have millions of customers. So,
sure,
you know, it's easier for us to come in and go, I've started fresh relatively recently and go, okay, well, oh, that's, you should change that. And by starting fresh, you can. It's a lot tougher to change an existing system, especially when there's so many, you have so many customers live on it, knowing how it works. You have this whole ecosystem around knowing how it works. It's, you know, there's some practical reasons why it makes sense for this problem to be solved in different systems based on this specific customer type.
Like, it's amazing what people will make QuickBooks do that maybe no one had intended it to do. They have this wonderful class attribute, which gets used in a million different ways. And that's its own disadvantage, because now you have all of these people, different people sort of bending it to their will in all sorts of wonderful ways, but only they know what that way is if you ask them. So now your next accountant comes in and they're like, hold on, why is this set up this way? And I don't understand. And it's not sort of documented, because you're not documenting it in the software. You're not giving it a name that makes sense.
Yep.
And now someone, it's non-standard, and then forget it.
Yeah. What we've found is that's kind of the nature of a general ledger accounting system, and you just have to lean into that being what's going to happen and design it for that. And so, because, yeah, it's kind of a Swiss Army knife for doing your accounting, and then you want to formalize the processes you can and set your data structure down, but it's always going to be different, and you can standardize across industries, try to have a chart of accounts that might work for a specific industry or industry subset, but there's always going to be these nuances that are a bit different. And it's kind of the purpose of the tool, is to take this unstructured data, whatever happens with your business, and try to like understand it, normalize it so that you can make sense of it.
I guess you have, like, on the axis of flexibility to inflexibility, you have Excel on one hand. Mm-hmm. You can do everything in Excel if you wanted.
Right.
And then you can do it maybe, I don't know, maybe QuickBooks is on the other end. It's just a one way. And then you just kind of, and in the middle, you know, you need something between those two. Enough structure, but not too much.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think QuickBooks is even on the general side. If you think this one of the spectrum being like an expert system where you go in like a TurboTax or something where you just ask questions and it's like, this is how the form works. And so there's we know where we're going to end up. And here's a like decision tree that goes there. If it's very specific what the output should be, you can do that. And then as it becomes less clear what that output should be and there's more variability, I think then you start generalizing. As you generalize, you get more flexibility, like you said, but then you lose automation. If you can build an expert system for something, that would be great. That would probably be the ideal solution, assuming nothing changes, because you could automate every step along the way. But of course, the only constant is change within businesses, and you want to launch a new venture, new product line,
sure,
expand in a new country. All of a sudden, everything kind of looks a little bit different. You have to kind of make everything malleable, is what we found.
What's the most common other alternative? You decided you're done with QuickBooks. It's groaning. It's taking too long to run a report. There's no multi-user access. There's no scoping. There's no budgeting properly, whatever. What's the next most common thing people look at?
NetSuite is what we see mostly. NetSuite and Sage Intacct are the biggest ones, but it's mostly NetSuite.
And like NetSuite, again, I guess both of us would love to have the problems that QuickBooks and NetSuite have with millions of customers, etc. But what's the downside of going straight to something like NetSuite?
It's complicated to implement. It's complicated to use. It's expensive. Requires more people to use it. When you get into a very complicated use case, the depth of the tables is really where broadly we have the same functionality as a NetSuite. We have all the kind of modules to do everything you'd need as a business. But as you start getting in deeper into sub-vendors, and a sub-vendor has different addresses and is related to a location in some bespoke way, like, you can probably do something more like that in a NetSuite type system. So at some point, it makes sense to do, your business is complex enough and maybe makes sense for that type of use case. But if multi-entity consolidation is the only reason you're moving off of QuickBooks, or it's one of the other pieces of functionality that can't, you know, could be standardized in a system like ours, why take on all that additional complexity when you don't need it?
Well, that's the trick. Like, there's a no man's land in the middle there. And I've seen this with other software platforms as well. In fact, we upgraded to a professional version of HubSpot recently. And we upgraded. It was quite a big deal because we were hanging on like dear life to like some sort of startup plan that they gave us 10 years ago. And
Like
50 cents a month or something. And then eventually they persuaded us to go something else. And then we did that. And I'm like, okay, now all my problems are going to be over. And then they turned around and said to me, okay, well, now you should probably hire someone, a data analyst, to like wrangle the data. And I'm like, what? So no, it was 1500 quid now. And then an extra, God knows what, $7,000 or $8,000 on top of that, just to run the software. And these systems have their own professional ecosystem, which makes sense for them. It's not really advertised. Like, yeah, the software is only the sticker price, but then the ecosystem, which that software vendor encourages because it's part of their business model.
Yep.
You know, the more experts you have out there consulting, and I guess one level up from that would be SAP or something like that, definitely in Europe here,
yep,
where it's, you know, it's a whole other level and stuff. So you're right. There's a big gap in the middle there. How does Soft Ledger sort of fill that gap without having the need for professional services, I guess? And let's start with this multi-dimensional ledger. What the hell is that?
Multi-dimensional chart of accounts is what we provide, which is kind of what in any mid-market accounting system. So like step up from a bookkeeping system, you should have multiple dimensions that you can tag to each transaction line called a journal entry. It just means like what I was talking about earlier about the departments, like marketing, sales, legal, they all have their department codes. Maybe there's another like project dimension where you have different, you know, projects that need to get tracked on the cost side. Now, like projects could have revenue associated with them. So you can start to bring that in. Maybe you have we have a product dimension that would track the revenue separately. So you're now splitting things out into having a transaction kind of all this contextual data with it when it's booked. And that's really for reporting downstream. And that enables you to do things where if you don't have that detail, you don't have the detail to report on later. You'd have to go back and do like kind of an ad hoc analysis each time to try to get it. And that might be like literally reading invoices and all this that just doesn't work at scale. And so we provide that in a product focused, easy to learn way for a expert accounting user. Usually, you know, our ideal customer has a experienced CFO or controller that can do that. And so that's our way of saying like, okay, you don't necessarily need to hire consultants for this. If you want to pick it up and get it going yourself, which often makes the most sense for a company in that stage, we want to enable you to do that. Or, you know, we do have partners that can help, you know, we help answer questions internally and get on calls and do all the things, you know, but we're a software provider. So if there is additional services, we are creating that ecosystem as well. But it's kind of, it's not a binary, like there's the ecosystem and you have to do the enterprise sales route or no one talks to you and you can't get anyone on the phone. So we're kind of like straddling the line there in between, which we think is, you know, that's the new way. It's just, you know, use software to automate as much as possible, make it as easy as possible to use, allow people that want to just use it to use it themselves, but then, you know, have an ecosystem of partners that can help to the extent that you need.
Once you have that financial director or CFO in, they have a level of sophistication. Maybe they're used to bigger systems mm-hmm. and they're used to being able to pull bigger reports, but they've moved into an SMB role mm-hmm. and now they want that same reporting functionality that they were used to when they were spending $750,000 a year on their accountancy software.
Yeah, and we've had people come off of Oracle and ask all the very detailed questions that a huge system like that does. And there's a lot of no's there. We don't do that next level little nitpicky thing, but they kind of go, okay, they get it that like some of the things go away, but it's a complex analysis. There's trade-offs, but on one side is this huge ticket sticker price for the software each year.
Yeah, I mean, that's the art and the science of the software. It's like this spectrum I think we were talking about earlier is getting the point along there somewhere that's useful enough, not structured enough, not too structured. You developed an interesting niche. You're mentioning a conference you're going up to soon for some of your customers. So tell us about that niche and why have you been more successful there than with, you know, other niches?
A lot of our customers use digital assets in their operations. So crypto, Bitcoin, Ethereum, a lot of other chains. We kind of have a large swath of the different types of crypto companies as customers now. And that started in 2017. We got it. Jeff and I got interested in crypto and realized, oh, this is very complicated to track. We actually had some prospects reach out and say, can you help us with this? And so that led to us releasing a crypto-specific module in August of 2018. And the idea was really just, it's kind of, when you distill it down, it's the same as anything else. Just your business is dealing in this complicated asset. How do you get into your financials and manage your business properly so you can still do the things you want to do? And so that's how we have approached it, is we actually created a new module within our accounting system, much like the inventory module, but this is focused on managing digital assets. It's just it's an interesting, ever evolving world, and now it's getting increasingly more political too, bipartisan. Hopefully, it's seeming like this is the latest push.
Are these digital exchanges you're working with, or are they just holding companies like investment funds that are buying crypto? And then
it's a mix. So yeah, in investment funds, financial services companies like exchanges, other financial services companies, there's, you know, ATM operators, there's a whole host of those type, like crypto fintech, you could describe it as. Some are, they look like a normal fintech company and they're using crypto on the back end, which is, I think, the most interesting because it's just leveraging the technology to do something that exists already more efficiently. And then we have on-chain, like blockchain-based protocols or the foundations that govern them that we're working with. And so those are really, sometimes the entity is a software company, sometimes it's a foundation, so it's a nonprofit that governs the software. So We really cover a full gamut of the different types of companies there. And it's been a really interesting industry. It's been great to see it evolve over the past several years.
When these guys are accounting, when you're running their accounting, do you have to mark everything back to dollars for your reports, or do you mark it in its native currency?
Yes. So that's the complication, is somewhere that there's an organization that is in a real location, you know, at least for any of our customers. If you're putting together accounting records, you probably have a physical location somewhere or multiple. And those physical locations you need to report on in some fiat currency. So US dollars, euros, pounds, Singapore dollars. And the conversion of your activity in crypto into that reporting currency, that has to happen as you're transacting in it. And then for any unrealized gains or losses, depending on your jurisdiction, you either mark it to market or impair it, and a jurisdiction and asset type. So it just gets really complicated, and it gets complicated early. So you could be a 10 employee company and have this very complicated, tricky thing to track. And then multi-entity, what we were talking to about before, ties into this, and then regular fiat currency. And so it's just, you're embarking on this new innovative thing. And it's like, it actually is a very complicated thing to track.
So I can see how, okay, everyone does their taxes, death and taxes. You got to, at the end of the day, create a balance sheet and an income statement for a crypto company. And that'll have swung all over the place, I'm guessing, in a lot of cases all year. And at a point in time, 31st of December, maybe they have to cut an income statement and a balance sheet and pay their taxes. That's one instance where you're going to need a reporting system, because the government just needs to know in fiat. Now, are there other instances like covenants with banks, or what other sort of instance do you really need to sort of reflect everything in dollars?
Let me give an example of a Bitcoin miner. Miners are used to process transactions on the Bitcoin network, and they earn fees for this. And actually, all the major energy companies have some sort of Bitcoin mining initiative now, because it's got these interesting energy dynamics that they can play into. But you're earning Bitcoin as this company. At some point, you have control over it, and you've earned it, which is kind of a little bit judgmental when that point happens right now. Whatever that point is, you record it. And do you hold it, or do you sell it? If you hold it, are you just holding it as an investment? Are you holding it and then paying vendors with it because you can? Are you converting it into a US dollar stable coin, which is like just a representation of the US dollar? Based on that, you need to track the value, of course, and potentially market to market as it changes. And then if you, let's say you pay a vendor with Bitcoin, well, you got it at $62,000. Per Bitcoin, and you pay it, and it's now $73,000 per Bitcoin. Well, you have a gain on paying this bill for a vendor, which is kind of a weird concept. It doesn't exist with money. There are certain aspects of that exist across, like if you had pounds and then converted to dollars, and you report in dollars, there's some gain there. But that concept of literally just the time you pay with Bitcoin, having a gain or loss is kind of new, and it's difficult to track. And so that's one actually relatively simple example of where this comes up. As you get into like more complicated, like the protocols that do all this financial services type stuff, it gets more complicated. But it's just that repeated in, you know, with maybe multiple steps.
I see on my balance sheet, like bank revaluations and unrealized currency gains. It's like that, but on steroids, I guess, and you need it for each asset type.
Yeah, exactly. Some of the same complications exist, but money has standardization that helps accounting simplify the accounting for it. Whereas crypto is a bit more all over the place, and the way that it's tracked and needs to be reported on is a bit more detailed. And that just, there's just not an easy way to do it. And so navigating through that, and
right,
regulations are sometimes like are getting clearer. in some cases, it's pretty clear how you should report. And then in some cases, it's not. And so you kind of have to navigate all through this. It would be a great starting point to have like all your financial data very clear and visible, so that you can then make the very judgmental decisions that probably will involve legal teams and regulatory experts. But you need that starting point first. And so that's tough enough on its own.
I mean, it's hard enough even with normal currencies. And then I guess it's the same concept largely. It's just you expect more variation.
And it's the assets can represent different things, because there is buried in this is there's some things that look a lot like just a more efficient version of what's happening now. But then there's some new things where like this is a bit different than something that's existed prior. And so how do I fit this into the existing paradigm? It presents some complex challenges.
Okay.
And I think that's reflected in how long it's been taken to get some of these the regulatory clarity on a lot of this.
Well, about, I'm going to say 6 years ago, I was standing in the middle of South Africa in a farmland with a farmer, and we were out there walking on land, and he turns to me and says, "Hey, James, have you heard of this thing called Bitcoin?" And I was like, "Oh, it's time for this guy to get out anyway." That was a terrible decision, of course. I should have stayed in, but I was like, if a farmer in deepest, darkest South Africa was telling me about Bitcoin, I was like, it's too late, it's over. But of course, I'll put it with the rest of my investment advice and strategies.
Very, very difficult to know years ago. It became clearer as more people use it and all that, for sure. But yeah, it's some of the remote areas are actually the most interested, because depending on how you're storing your money, some places the currency being volatile enough ends up attracting you to maybe not Bitcoin, but like a stable coin, seem more attractive in a lot of cases. Yeah.
How can people reach out to SoftLedger or yourself if they want to find out more?
You can visit us on our website at softledger.com, or you can reach out to me directly at ben@softledger.com. But yeah, thank you for having me on. This was great.
It's been a pleasure meeting you. I loved nerding out about this stuff. Thanks, Ben. And if you're listening to the podcast still, congratulations. You are now entitled to a very special privilege, which is to sign up to our newsletter. You can get it at procurementexpress.com/newsletter. You get to see my smiling face plop into your inbox every Thursday afternoon or so, where you'll have more fascinating interviews from founders like Ben. If you are a software founder that sells to finance teams, especially in the mid-market, I'd love to hear from you, have a chat like this today, hopefully provide some value to the audience, which is largely SMB finance teams.